and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly, the show that promises to keep your whites bright and turn your milk chocolatey. This week, we get the closest we can possibly get to Santa in the form of robotics whiz kid Caleb Chung. He's the man behind the lovable dinosaur Pleo and the equal parts lovable and irritating Furby.
Me, Furby. Me, tell me stories. You listen. Beautiful.
Actually, having heard that, I'm not sure it is necessarily a 50-50 lovable, irritating split. Anyway, Caleb will be telling us about how he turned his love of robotics into some must-have Christmas gifts. We also hear from Brightcove, who provide a video hosting platform for the likes of Channel 4, BSkyB, and in fact, The Guardian. Mercedes Buns finds out why they're more than just another YouTube. My name's Susie Weezer, and this week I'm joined remotely by Bobby Johnson and IOL by Digital Research Editor Kevin Anderson. Hi. Bobby, we're on show 101 today, so it seems only right to ask you what piece of tech you'd send to room 101.
101, bloody hell. I think right now I'd send Gmail to 101, to room 101. It's gone down. I'm stranded without my email. What do I do? This is the problem with living in the cloud, isn't it?
We're all I believe you're supposed to actually speak to people. Kevin, what about you? What would you send to room 101?
I think I'd send that gadget that tweets when your plant needs watering, because I've killed so many herbs in my kitchen. I need something to remind me to
keep them. You're keeping that. Fair enough. Yeah, okay. So that's the last you'll be hearing of Crap Tech, as this show is set to deliver you nothing less than market-leading, chart-topping, record-breaking, world-beating technology in handy, bite-sized chunks. So grab your cup of tea and join us as we embark on another Guardian Tech Weekly. Caleb Chung is best known for creating the adorable Pleo dinosaur, which was sadly a victim of its own economic ice age when the company behind it, Ugobi, went into administration this year. But he's had a long and varied career history, with highlights including stuntman, street entertainer, and designer of some of the most iconic McDonald's Happy Meal giveaways. He's known for having a passion for invention, toys, and robotics. So Kevin started by asking Caleb where it all began for him.
I actually started out as an entertainer. So I was a street mime, actually, for several years, which today may be a four-letter word, but back then it was pretty fun to do, a lot of busking, a lot of performing. And there were lots of lessons that I learned from being a street performer that carried through into my inventing career. One was what makes people tick and why people find things interesting, how their minds work. And you have to be able to read people very well if you have a theater without seats. And so I got a job at Mattel, and before that I actually had done some special effects for films. I just kind of picked up mechanical things. I have a mechanical aptitude. And actually I picked up doing special effects because I was put inside of these special effects suits because I was a mime. So then I got interested in mechanics, and then I started doing that and followed that path for a while. And then when that slowed down and I missed a part in a TV show as a beaver for a Hallmark show, I took a job at Mattel and I brought in all my effects stuff that I'd built, and they hired me in this R&D group. And it was like toy college to me. I basically ran for 5 years. I ran around learning things. It was fantastic. So then after that, I became an independent inventor and did a lot of development for toy companies. Every time you had some spare time, you would invent a product and try to license it to a company. And so after about 10 years or so of being in the business, we hit on this Furby idea, my wife and I and a friend, Dave Hampton. The friction between art and science is innovation, and new ideas spring. Kind of a long answer, but Furby came out of that intersection of art and science and business.
Why did you decide to focus on toys?
Focusing on toys was never really my focus to begin with. I kind of fell into the job, but it was I focused on my passion and what I was interested in, and that led into toys because it was an entertainment product that had a physicalized form that had interesting mechanics or parts to it. You would make these in the tens and thousands and hundreds of thousands, and so that you could take technology and make it very inexpensive. So it would, because of economies of scale, you could take, you know, like Shell Oil came in and they showed a new polymer, and we could actually make that in the volumes that would make it a low price. So with toys, it was a way to be able to play with high technology at a very low cost for the consumer. You'll see that most great technologies have a place in toys. But toys are wonderful because they boil down to the essentials of something, because you don't have a lot of fluff in there. You don't have a lot of money for fluff. So when the world was going when Microsoft was adding more and more boards and more layers of technology, toys would take that same idea and pare it down to the just the smallest microprocessor that we could use. So my way actually of inventing, I exposed myself to a lot of new things that any artist, anyone who's an inventor needs to just fill their minds with new things. And so I read lots of stuff that I don't understand. I also read lots of science fiction. I walk up and down stores just for fun, and hardware stores, any kind of store, trade shows. I just look at things and I try to understand the why of them. I try to understand why that was made. I try to understand how it was made, and I try to see if it had a business model. And if you deconstruct enough successful things, you start to see the balance of a good product. Your subconscious, I think, is the big engine. And the reason the idea pops out when you're relaxed is because then the wall between your subconscious and your conscious is very thin, and you have this aha moment. The aha moment is just you getting out of your own way and allowing the answer to come.
So how did the Furby come out of that aha process? Because, I mean, it really is an iconic toy.
I had been working for Microsoft for a little bit on the Microsoft Barney. The Microsoft Barney was a product that you hooked up to the PC, and it was kind of bloatware from a toy standpoint. There was a lot of stuff in it, and it actually did very little relative to how much was in it. I got together with my friend Dave Hampton, who came out of the same group at Mattel. He's an electronics person, software writer, and we went to Toy Fair, and I'd always wanted to do a life form, something that was alive, felt like it was alive. If you come from the movie industry, they don't try to make fake things. When you see a little creature in a movie, it's alive. You believe it's alive. And that belief in life is what's so fascinating, because then it enters into your life as a companion. I'm not playing with you. You're playing with me. We're doing this together. That's a completely different attitude. And I tried to sell the idea of an electronic pet at Mattel for years. But no, people said, well, what do you do with it? You know, it's a pet. If you actually think about what a pet does, it's hard to define in terms of product features. You know, they will say, hey, he can blink his eyes and he can say 10 sounds. Well, you'd never say that about your dog, but there's other things going on with a pet that are much more sticky for humans. Empathy is one of them. You can only feel empathy towards something if you believe it's alive enough that you would care for it like that. The perfect toy is a teddy bear without technology, because you're free to project anything you want, and it comes to life as your imagination would will it to. If you take a half step and you put batteries in a doll and it says, squeeze my hand and count, I'll count to 10, and then you say, I want to play, you know, a tea party, well, then the doll says, okay, I'm going to sleep because you're not squeezing my hand. That's a broken relationship. So the trick in Furby was to give it some basic sight, some basic hearing, a basic idea that if I'm being picked up and moved, something is happening, and tying those things together. So when you clap your hands or there's something goes on and you're in a car, it responds as another person would. It's only smart in a way that humans care about. The last thing we did was let it acquire language. Now, it really didn't acquire language, but it appeared to, it started with the Furby language, and the longer you had it, it basically transposed phrases until it was speaking mostly English or pidgin English. That turns out to be a holy grail for humans. If something actually acquires English, boy, that it must be smart. And it got banned from the Pentagon because they thought it was much smarter than it actually is. It cost $5 to make in Asia. You know, landed in a box in Long Beach, it was like $5-6 to make. So there's no way, even being very clever, that it had very high technology. And that completely worked. People treated it at a large extent as something that was alive. And that's why it took off.
That was Kevin Anderson there talking to Caleb Chung. Bobby, there's little doubt that the Pleo was absolutely groundbreaking in terms of the amount of robotics put into its kids' toy, but it seems to have been a little expensive for a mass market toy. Do you think the cost of robotics has to go down before we see something like that again?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the thing is, obviously a lower price makes something less risky financially, but as you heard Caleb said there, that a Furby, as opposed to a Pleo, only costs $5 or $6 to make. So it's, you can kind of achieve some things on a very low with a very low investment, I think. And if you look at companies, robotics, consumer robotics companies like iRobot, who make the Roomba vacuum, they're not doing so badly. They're, you know, they're still in business. So I think one of the problems is that the toy industry itself is pretty fickle, and you have to have a massive, absolutely massive hit to kind of secure your future. And you have to be very, very clever and very savvy about how you market everything. And I think the Pleo was always marketed as this kind of expensive, high-end look. It's kind of artificial life kind of thing. And I think that was maybe a bit beyond the reach of the ordinary Christmas shopper.
Mm. So, Kevin, is it all over for Pleo, this tiny dinosaur?
No, it's been given a bit of a reprieve from extinction. One of the manufacturers has actually reinvested in it. So I think we are going to see the Pleo live again.
Thank goodness. Now, Bobby, where does innovation robotics come from as a rule? Is it people tinkering in their garages? Is it NASA? Is it universities? Where does it start?
Well, I think most of the major developments tend to come out of universities. MIT does a lot of robotics work. Carnegie Mellon does a lot of robotics work. And various other universities, lots in Japan as well. And also from the car companies. I mean, the kind of iconic robot that we all think of at the moment, I think, is probably Honda's Asimo, which, you know, is a weird little beast, but is the car companies, when they're making money, kind of invest a lot in robotics because it helps them with manufacturing. I mean, one of the biggest successes in kind of consumer robotics recently has been Robo Sapiens, another toy that kind of operates on it's slightly lower level than Pleo, and that was done by Mark Tilden, who is really more of a kind of solo tinkerer than these big universities and stuff. Although Mark's background was, you know, he worked at Los Alamos and kind of on all kinds of really high tech projects. So, you know, it's I think it comes generally from the big brains and then filters down to various other people along the way.
So robotics, everyone's at it, basically.
Oh yeah, it's filthy.
And on that note, it's now time to hear from the wider technology world. So sit back as we take you through the latest tech headlines.
The government in Australia has revealed new laws which will require all ISPs based in the country to block material deemed unsuitable by an independent body which will consider public opinion. If ISPs refuse, they face huge penalties. It's expected the laws will be discussed by the Australian Parliament next summer and will take a year to put into place. One of the creators of a technology that underpins millions of websites is asking people to protest against Oracle's attempted takeover of Silicon Valley rival Sun Microsystems. Finnish entrepreneur Michael Wudenius says that the European Commission must block the $7 billion deal as a way to protect the future of MySQL, the open source database company he helped found in 1995. The Teletext Information Service, which broadcasts on ITV, Channel 4 and 5, is to close its editorial arm. Subtitles and commercial offerings such as holiday sales and games are not affected. Owner Associated Newspapers said the service had been loss-making in recent years and no viable business model could be found. And The Guardian has launched an app for the iPhone which allows you to customise and read content offline, browse picture galleries and even listen to this podcast on the move. The app costs £2.39 and at the time of recording was top of the iTunes paid apps chart. You can find it at guardian.co.uk/iPhone.
Brightcove was created in 2004, providing a video platform for media titles. It's kind of like a YouTube for companies interested in posting more than just videos of lolsome cats. The main difference with Brightcove is that they allow their customers to control the look of the video players, as well as, crucially, which adverts will be displayed and how.
Welcome to Brightcove, the essential platform for every professional online video project. The Brightcove platform is a simple web application with everything you need to easily organize, publish, and monetize online video.
What they don't tell you in that clip is that they've taken over $90 million in funding and that the first Forrester Research study into online video platforms ranked them as the top performing company in the industry. Their latest release, version 4, offers better live streaming, better iPhone integration, and more advanced analytics, so they're certainly not resting on their laurels. Mercedes-Benz started by asking Jeremy Allaire, Brightcove CEO, what events led up to making Brightcove the success it is today?
Well, I think a convergence of things came together to make video much more important. Formats like Flash made it possible for every website to be able to use video because every consumer could watch it. Broadband adoption has made it much easier to deliver this content and get it out to users. And I think we've also seen a kind of democratization of the tools of production. So you really are seeing that camera technology, the performance of personal computers and laptops, video editing software, all these things have gotten more and more easy to adopt and inexpensive. And so all those things coming together really was creating a perfect storm for an online video publishing revolution, and we're right in the midst of it.
You were once talking about television and video mingling, and that was one of the visions of your company. But online video still feels a lot like television. Where is the interaction? Will we ever get to an interactive video?
When I was starting this company, I thought that the future was not just playing back videos, but actually providing applications where you could do things around the video, or video could drive you into other activities. And it turned out that in this first phase of online video adoption, most of the publishers of that content really just want to get that content up and available in a high-quality way that they can use in their business. But I think we're right at the beginning of a new phase, and I do think that what that's going to represent is people getting a lot more creative about how video fits into broader interactive applications, whether it be for commerce or for education or for entertainment or for information, you know, sharing. So I think we're right on the beginnings of that. I don't yet know what form that will take. I don't think there's enough user history to understand what's usable and what users prefer. We do have 70 years of history with linear video and experiencing that as humans, and we're very comfortable with that. We don't have much history yet on interactive video, but I do see that forthcoming for sure.
Distribution with video gets more and more important. Users don't watch video on one side anymore. Can you tell us a little bit what's happening there?
Sure. When we actually launched Brightcove commercially back in early 2006, we had this idea of distributing video, not just on your own site, but a video syndication and kind of embedding it out in lots of other places, whether it be consumers sharing that content or creating relationships with other sites that you might work with and syndicating that content. And gradually that started to take hold. I think the publishers of content have realized that in this highly fragmented environment where users can move about on the internet incredibly quickly, and there's very little loyalty to any given website, maybe other than Google. The mantra needs to be, you know, reach consumers and viewers where they are, not where you want them to be. So the first instinct is, oh, they're all going to, you know, come here. But you need to reach them in other places and see that that's kind of a blended distribution strategy, and it's a way to introduce people to your brand and draw them in. And if you get someone who's really engaged and interested in your content, then maybe they would become more loyal to your specific website and property. And so most savvy publishers of video are now embracing kind of creating these audience networks for their video that span social networks, portals, sharing sites, you know, syndication partners, and their own site as well.
Why still everybody thinks of YouTube when they think of a video company online?
YouTube is obviously a consumer phenomenon. It's a kind of an institution for consumers. It's almost like Google for search. It's actually a search engine, even number two search engine. But as a platform that people would use for their own websites, where they can have, you know, control over their content and the branding and the use of their content, it's not really a viable option for people today. So maybe when people get started putting video online, they might put a few videos up on YouTube. But as they start to want to make it a more central part of what they do in their own websites and manage that in an integrated and consistent way, then they start to need online video platforms. So I think we're now definitely moving into this new phase where professional software services like Brightcove are gaining preeminence and interest among the broader website publishing community. And I'm hopeful that we actually could grow to a much larger market share in the broader audience of web publishers.
That was Mercedes-Benz speaking to Brightcove CEO Jeremy Allaire. Now, Kevin, if YouTube offered a more professional player where you could completely customize your player and control the advertising, presumably Brightcove would be out of a niche. Do you think this is something YouTube will ever offer?
Well, they're already, they've partnered with Channel 4 and ITV now to actually almost be a video archive for them. So I think one of the things we're seeing is more professional players move into YouTube. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, the big players want the audience that YouTube has. But from the flip side of it, YouTube, to pay for all of the, you know, gigabytes of data that it uses every month, has to have somebody more than just kind of, you know, people surfing in urinals and cat videos. So, you know, there's kind of a push and pull on both sides for YouTube.
Okay. Well, Brightcove itself has recently launched an express service where people can pay $99 rather than monthly fees that have previously run into hundreds of dollars. Bobby, do you think this indicates they're hoping to become a company that are used by consumers like YouTube are rather than businesses?
I think, to be honest, the fact that the low price point is more about drawing more publishers, more online video publishers in, because it's less of a vast jump from free to something to $99. Although I think the problem is that we can't stop talking about YouTube here, because Free is a massive benefit. It's really hard, for anyone to break the dominance that YouTube's already set up. Like Jeremy said, you know, it's actually the second largest web search engine after Google, which owns it already. It's a really difficult situation for anyone to move into and kind of become a consumer brand. The only people who have managed it are the broadcasters themselves, with iPlayer or with Hulu. That's the only place they seem to have the penetration these days.
Kevin, what about online video more generally? Has it had the impact that it was predicted to a few years ago, or are we still kind of holding out for that big break?
Well, I think it's shifting quite a bit. I mean, Bobby was just talking about Hulu and the iPlayer, and that has now led to a real push to move online video from, you know, your desktop computer, your laptop. People are trying to shift that into the living room. And so I think the interesting thing we're starting to see is online video is now just video, and it's just another way that we watch video. And if you see some of these set-top box software, things like Boxy or the Roku box, Roku, you can't tell what's online video and what's, you know, downloaded rental video. And so I think the internet's just becoming another delivery platform.
So when you lose the distinction, that's kind of when they win.
When it gets to a 40-inch screen, nobody cares.
Fair enough, yeah.
In the last ever Guardian Tech section with this Thursday's paper, we review the decade in tech and games. Microsoft, Apple, Google, crowdsourcing, they're all in there. We'll tell you where you can read about technology now in the Guardian. We'll be online, on the iPhone, in the paper, G2, and in the Observer. We look to the future to predict what's the most important technology for your company in the next 5 years. And former tech section editors discuss their experiences of putting it together. It's all in the final tech section with Thursday's Guardian.
So that's it for another week. I'd like to thank Caleb Chung and Jeremy Allaire, as well as Kevin Anderson and Bobby Johnson. Kevin, before we go, what's been your favourite robotic toy over the years?
Favorite robotic toy? I like Lego Mindstorm. I just think it's cool. I mean, it kind of merges that 1970s, yeah, I'm that old, toys with sort of my geeky tendency. So I think Mindstorm takes
proper robotics where you can see the working bits.
Absolutely, and have a play.
I think I'd go the other end of the spectrum to old school Teddy Ruxpin. Now, next week, we've got our top tech highlights of 2009 show, bringing you the brightest and the best of this year. And the week after, we'll be making our predictions for 2010. But until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.